Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Iraq has the world's second largest proven oil reserves, second only to Saudi Arabia's. Its massive potential wealth could undergird a flourishing post-war Iraq. It could also fuel a wild scramble for stakes and oil spoils. Tonight, On Point, Iraq's future, Iraq's oil. Begin with a look at the war in Iraq from an Israeli perspective. Washington has demanded and received a very quiet Israel as war rages, but Israelis are paying close attention. I spoke earlier with David Landau, editor of the English edition of the Israeli daily newspaper Haaretz. I asked him how Israelis are absorbing the war.
Probably the closest analogy is American with Midwest. I think really people here are very, very much rooting for the American and British forces. They're following the developments avidly. When it seemed that the attack on Baghdad was slowing down and the war wasn't going so well for the coalition, a pall of gloom seemed to settle over the Israeli public. And now that it's going better, there's a distinct sense of, I think, encouragement. People want to see America and Britain win this war and win it quickly and win it with relatively few casualties.
And what are Israelis thinking would come from such an outcome?
Well, of course, there you tread into the well-trodden and dangerous ground of Israeli politics. You see, Israeli society is still deeply divided about the future of Israel, so that those on the left, so to speak, of Israeli society, the more pro-peace, pro-compromise forces in Israel, are hoping and praying that this American Bush administration will act after the war in Iraq the way the previous Bush administration acted after the previous war in Iraq.
That is to lean in and get active and push hard for peace.
Yes, exactly. And so on the left, there's a real sense of anticipation. On the right, and of course the right includes the government of the day, there is some trepidation about the exact same scenario. And that's why you hear this talk about the roadmap which the U.S. State Department has evolved for a peace process in this region. And people on the right are saying, does this roadmap actually reflect President Bush's sentiments and sympathies, which we on the right of the Israeli spectrum have felt to be friendly towards us?
Is there a vivid sense of wartime in Israel? Are there special security precautions? Are people walking around with a sense of heightened danger or not?
Well, there was when it broke out, but I think the government and the civil defense authorities are finding it very difficult to maintain any such sense of alertness or readiness because of the fact that no Scud missiles have been fired, even at Kuwait. The missiles that were fired at Kuwait were not of long enough range to reach Israel, and so there was a certain sense of relief here about that. No Scud missiles were unearthed in the western desert. And anyway, the American forces have taken control, as far as can be understood, of much of the western desert. And so the fears of Israel being attacked by missiles, the way it was in the first war, have lessened. And I think that now that the final phase of the war is at hand and the attack on Baghdad itself looms nearer, the government is going to try and jack up, even artificially, jack up this necessary sense of emergency just in case Saddam, with his back to the wall, does fire off a missile with a chemical warhead, if he has such a one.
Internationally, Israel has appeared extraordinarily quiet during these last 2 weeks at every level. Is this a deliberate government policy to keep the country's head way down during this war?
I think both the Israelis and the Palestinians were told in unmistakable language by the U.S. administration that we want to hear nothing from you, we want to see nothing from you, we want you to stay out of it. And both the Israelis and the Palestinians, from their differing perspectives and with their differing interests, have done their best, the leaderships, the governments, have done their best to keep things cool on both sides. Now, there was a suicide bombing in Israel last week. There were many injuries, but there weren't any fatalities. So that didn't grab headlines around the world, even though people were hurt. There was no one killed. And that's why it's been possible to keep the Intifada conflict between the Israelis and the Palestinians off the American front pages, which is exactly where the administration wants it.
And what about Israelis' view or commentators' views there of the Arab world? We see reports of a lot of anger and even of sympathy toward Iraq sentiment in the Arab world. Is there any concern that you're detecting in Israel, widespread, that an anti-American sentiment may lead to more friction for Israel as well post-Iraq war?
Yes, there were the beginnings of that sort of concern when it looked that the war was sinking into a sort of doldrums period, and when a lot of guerrilla fighting seemed to be replacing the surge of armor and large formations. So there was that kind of apprehensiveness. But now that the war seems to be moving forward with increased momentum, the feeling here in Israel is once again more optimistic, and the hope that this war will not deteriorate, so to speak, into guerrilla warfare, and that the end will come quickly, and that the Americans will be able to install some kind of post-Saddam regime with relative speed. That seems to be the prevailing sentiment here. Also, I think it's fair and necessary to point out that Israeli commentators discern, it's not that difficult to discern, a significant gap in many Arab countries, some of the neighboring Arab countries particularly, between sentiment on the street and sentiment in the governments. And you're seeing that in Jordan, you're seeing that in Egypt. The only place perhaps where you're not seeing that nearby here is in Syria, where government and people are solidly four square behind Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi regime. But I think President Mubarak of Egypt and the King of Jordan have made no secret of their personal and their official desire to see an end to the Iraqi regime. Also, I'd like to point out to you something which might sound gruesome, but it's nevertheless my duty as a reporter to point it out. When American forces have in the last few days unwittingly, unintendedly hurt or killed civilians in guerrilla-type terrorist situations where, for instance, at that roadblock they fired at a car full of civilians, there's a certain sense in Israel of, you see, even the Americans sometimes, it happens even to them. So why have we been the subject of so much criticism around the world when this sort of thing happens to us?
A sense of now you know what we're up against.
Yeah, they produce some kind of sort of vicarious comfort for Israelis who feel that they've been hard done by world opinion.
But at the same time, of course, Americans are longing to see a clear end to this and troops coming home, but Israelis know how these conflicts can go on. Do you foresee a crisp end to this war?
I think people in Israel, and indeed in other countries, are looking to whether the international community, or what's left of the communality of the international community, is going to be prepared to step in after the fighting and assist in the reconstitution of a peacetime Iraq. If this turns into a protracted American occupation, then the dangers which you predict may well come to pass. If, on the other hand, it becomes an international regime or United Nations mandate in which other political forces in Iraq are encouraged to come to the fore, that would be a very different scenario. So I think Israelis, along with other people of goodwill, are looking and hoping to the day when Iraqi politicians are encouraged by a lot of outside forces, not just the Americans and British who fought the war, to take over their country.
Well, I don't want to predict anything, but I think everybody looks forward to that day. And David Landau, I thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
David Landau, editor of the English edition of the Israeli daily newspaper Haaretz. He spoke with us earlier from Tel Aviv. In Iraq, both war and peace float on an ocean of oil. When war finally ends, who taps that oil, how they do it, and where the money flows will have a huge impact on the country's politics, its prosperity, its very sovereignty. If managed well, its oil could help Iraq to flourish and usher the country into the global economy. If mishandled, it could create a fiery storm of conflict inside and outside the country. Can you see oil nurturing a rich, new, democratic, independent Iraq? Or not? What's the best way to help that happen? And should America have any special claim on oil business in Iraq? Join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Newton, Massachusetts, is Morris Edelman, Professor Emeritus of Economics at MIT. His essay, Iraq's Oil for Sale to the Highest Bidder, appeared today in the Wall Street Journal. Good evening and welcome, Morris Edelman.
Good evening.
Also joining us tonight is Daniel Yergin, chairman of Cambridge Energy Research Associates. His six-part TV series, Commanding Heights, The Battle for the World Economy, will re-air nationally this May on PBS. Good evening and welcome, Daniel Yergin.
Good evening.
Moore Salemon, we want to get into your thoughts about how war should, will be handled, or oil will be handled after war in Iraq. But could you just first outline the dimensions of Iraq's oil for us? They're enormous. I'm not sure everyone understands quite what a great oil reserve Iraq has.
No, nobody knows what that is. And it's a mistake to call it a reserve anyway. You can say that they have about 25 billion barrels in underground assets, and we know the amount pretty well. We have some idea of what it would cost to get that back into operation. And it's worth, in very round numbers, about $100 billion. Farther out, while there's a lot of oil there, nobody knows how much. Nobody knows what it would cost to get it above ground. And above all, when it does come to be produced, it's going to be by a technology and a science that's very different from what we have today. So I think the beginning of wisdom is not to try to estimate those so-called reserves with any exactitude. We can be sure of only one thing, that they will be worth a lot of money when they're sold off in some orderly way.
And as you say, that there's an awful lot unknown about just how large that quantity of oil may be. Daniel Yergin, we can only imagine that at any time, oil in that volume attracts an awful lot of attention in the fluidity of war, that people are sharpening knives and trying to figure out how to get a claim on this oil or get a tap into the oil business post-war in Iraq.
I think it's more sharpening their pencils than their knives at this point.
Mm-hmm. Explain.
I think there's so much focus on Iraq, and as Professor Edelman says, there's a lot that's not known. Its reserves are about the same size, so-called proven reserves, as Kuwait, United Arab Emirates, Iran. All the Persian Gulf countries in 1986 arbitrarily just raised their reserves by 50%. It had to do with OPEC quotas.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, actually, people keep saying Iraq has the second largest reserves in the world. It actually has the third largest. Canada has the second. And I think what's, there's almost certainly now going to be a new Iraq, and lots of oil companies would like to participate. I think everybody's sort of on the sidelines to see what happens right now.
Moore Salemon, we're going to come back after a break that's coming up and look in detail at your plan for how this ought to be done. But are we at risk of a kind of battle royal over this oil, of old contracts being ditched, of America, of the United States saying we've got a special claim because we led this war effort? Is it right that that should happen or not?
My suggestion is that you put all these claims to zero and that you sell off the oil according to what people will pay for it.
It is a big auction, but do you foresee or do you hear already when you keep your ear to the ground, parties in Washington saying, look, we're spending a lot on this war, whatever Donald Rumsfeld may say, we deserve some payback post-war?
Well, I really have nothing useful to say about that, or not we deserve.
But okay. What I'm asking Daniel Yergin, is that out there?
Well, there are some people who say no French, no Russians. Others say that stake is the really the sovereignty and legitimacy of New Iraq, and that probably what a New Iraq ought to do is open its doors to everybody and have a lot of different companies from a lot of different countries there. I think it is very striking. I think right now in Washington, things are still very fluid in terms of thinking through what will be the system and who will be the Iraqis who will make the decision. But the one thing I do hear from a lot of people is to get those decisions into the hands of the Iraqis as soon as possible.
Mm. Moore Salemon describes a way that we might do that. We're talking tonight about the oil of Iraq and what happens with it post-Saddam. Lots of questions. Should America post-war have any special claim on Iraqi oil at all? Donald Rumsfeld says the oil belongs to the people of Iraq. How should they use it? Or do we have anything to say about that? Should Washington bill Iraq's oil fields for the cost of this war? Or is that Washington's burden to bear? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the oil of Iraq and what happens with it post-Saddam. Can you see oil nurturing a rich, new, democratic, independent Iraq, or does oil set the table for a new battle after the war? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight, Morris Edelman, Professor Emeritus of Economics at MIT, and author of the op-ed piece in today's Wall Street Journal, Iraq's Oil for Sale to the Highest Bidder. Also, Daniel Yergin, Pulitzer Prize winner and chairman of Cambridge Energy Research Associates. Morris Edelman, could you describe for us who has claims on Iraq's oil now legally, and how would you like to see it roll out into this open bidding process that you describe?
I don't know who has legal rights on Iraq oil. You need an international lawyer for that.
But we hear about Russian and French claims at the very least. Are there American claims in there as well or not? Do you know?
I think there are very few American claims. The Russians and the French make very large claims, so far as I can see, on the basis of rather modest amounts of money spent. If you take their claims at face value and say that they've spent thus much, then my suggestion is give them credit for that and go on from there. It's not going to make a great deal of difference.
And credit in a bidding process. Daniel Yergin, sorry, I hear you there.
We hear a lot about these contracts. The French contract is initialed but never signed because the French government wouldn't sign it along with the companies. The Russian contract is signed. The Iraqis revoked it. They put it back in. But these contracts are basically non-operational because under the UN sanctions, you couldn't be investing. So it's not like Russia or France is producing oil there today. It's really all about the future.
So there are kind of contracts in abeyance. I want to hear more Edelman's plan, but Daniel Yergin, can you paint for us what are the options for dealing with Iraq's oil in a post-war situation? Edelman talks about a bidding process, is that only one of many options?
Well, yes, I think that that's one way to go. I think that when you think about those things, you have to think about the nationalism within the country, and I think that new people who will be running Iraq will also be very nationalistic, and this will be very tied into the future, the sovereignty and legitimacy of the government. There are two parts to it. One is to get the existing production back in better shape, but production capacity has declined by 20%, and that probably takes a couple of years and maybe $5 billion. Then this expansion that people talk about, which if the reserves are there, could well happen, been waiting decades for it to happen, that could take another 5, 6, even 10 years and maybe $30 billion. So it's not an inexpensive thing. And the key question is, well, who will be making these decisions and how will they be making them? How quickly will they be coordinated? We hear that oil workers are already coming back into the fields around Basra in the southern part of the country. They're feeling more secure. And so these questions could be very imminent.
But is it inevitable that oil companies, including foreign oil companies, would be deeply involved in this? Or does Iraq, has it had a government-owned oil industry? Is that an option for the future?
Well, I think at this point, most of the Persian Gulf countries haven't opened up. But for a new Iraq, $30 billion is a lot of money. And so one way or the other, it almost certainly...
That is the $30 billion it would take to really open up their industry.
Yeah, to really add capacity.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they would tend to do is what other countries do is open it up to foreign companies and let the companies come in, spend the money, and then tax away, take most of it away as rents, as they call it. So I think, but there'll be some Iraqis who'll say, we have these, we know about these reserves, we don't need companies, we'll do it ourselves, but they don't have the money. And at the end of the day, for countries, what oil is really about is national revenues and how to build up those revenues mm-hmm. as fast as you can.
So, Morris Edelman, describe for us how the auction that you describe would work and what would its benefits be for Iraq, for oil companies?
Well, the Iraqis have got to make up their minds, and nobody can do it for them. Either they maximize the value of the oil that they have, and they get a lot of money that way, because the expenses, so-called, of reopening or increasing the industry are nothing but investments.
Mm-hmm.
They shouldn't be a load. They should be an inducement. And if the production rights are sold off, they will be an inducement. The Iraqis have got to choose between making money and having the visceral satisfaction of saying that they have, quote, their own industry.
You mean if they do it themselves, they won't make money, you're saying?
Oh, they'll make money all right, but not nearly as much as they would if they had been selling the rights to foreign companies.
So you're saying draw lines through the oil fields, create parcels, I'm not sure how it works, and then put each of these parcels up for bid, and any company from anywhere could bid on them.
That's right. The lines, by the way, are mostly put there by nature. We talk about a field, but a field is really a collection of reservoirs, and it becomes a matter of engineering judgment as to what a useful unit would be.
And what do you imagine that would produce? What would it look like? How big an involvement would the United States and Britain have? How big an involvement would other countries, Russia, France, China, others have?
As countries that have no involvement at all.
Well, they're oil companies, I should say.
Their oil companies would, depending on how much money they were willing to pay for producing rights. Now, there are countries like China, conspicuously now, Japan to a lesser extent, and others who have ideas about security, the idea that if they have their own companies producing the oil, they gain something. It's a delusion. But if they are willing to subsidize their companies to do that, then the Iraqis are going to get a little bit more.
But what's the quilt likely to look like? Are we likely to see lots of dominant role by the oil companies of any one nation, or will we see all kinds of nations if it's open bidding? Will everybody be represented?
Well, I don't think everybody will be represented. I think companies which are going concerns and have a proved record will be by far the most successful in bidding. But nations as such will have very little to do with this, and the less they have, the better, I think.
You've written that the United States and Britain have particular expertise and capital for the discovery and exploration and development of new areas. So might they end up as or companies flying these nations' flags end up as major players in the opening up of Iraq's oil industry?
I think you'd be back to a situation where you were many years ago, where most of the work was done and most of the money was made by American and British companies. But the profits would go to Iraq because the bidding process would see to that.
And how much money are we talking about for Iraq here?
Well, I would say that they can get $100 billion by selling off currently approved acreage. They can get a great deal more in the future, but I don't know what that is.
$100 billion on proven reserves or whatever you like to call it.
On proved producing, go a little bit wider than that.
Right, and you'd have then also bidding on unproven, but on the kind of let's go wildcatting and see what we find bids.
Well, there's a great deal that's intermediate
mm-hmm.
There. Acreage which is not producing, but which has been probed about a good deal and about which a good deal is known. Then beyond that, there are large areas which are prospective, but have not been explored.
And Daniel Yergin, one question for you. Does that $100 billion look like a good sum to $100 billion and auctioning these rights off to oil companies from around the world look like a good deal to Iraq, or does it look like an imperial carve-up post-war?
Well, I think in a sense, maybe both. I think that that's a lot of money, plus because right now Iraq has been earning maybe about $15 billion a year from its oil, its annual oil sales. So that would be a lot of money, and it would be continuing to earn its annual lion's share of the revenues, too. I have great respect for Professor Adelman. He's one of the great energy economists. But I think that the politics here would make that kind of scenario very problematic. Because you can see when you see 82% of the people in France are against the war, that if it ended up being primarily U.S. and British companies, it would be, I think, a major political setback. And a new Iraq would want Chinese companies there. It would want the Russian companies there. It would want the Japanese companies there, I believe, because all of this would help to bolster its legitimacy as a nation. And if it looked like it was, no matter that the economics of what Professor Edelman say make a great deal of sense, mm-hmm. but the optics of it and the politics of it would be, I think, inexplicable to an awful lot of people.
The optics. Daniel Jorgen, Morris Edelman, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Rod Al-Qadiri. He's a director at PFC Energy, a Washington-based oil consultancy. Good evening and welcome, Rod Al-Qadiri.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us. We're looking at Iraq's oil post-war, and we know we're not there yet, but it's such a big prize. Everyone will be thinking about it. How do you see anticipation of what happens of the war shaping up? Do you see companies of many different countries sharpening their knives, trying to figure out how to get, or their pencils, trying to figure out how to get their claim on this oil?
I'm glad you include the pencils as well as the knives.
Yes. Well, we're hoping for something that's peaceful there. But you're in Washington. Do you hear noises in Washington of the U.S. trying to design a process that leads to special rewards for American oil companies, or is it likely to be more open than that? Can you see it going to the high bidder? Is that not nationalistic enough for a post-war Iraq?
Right. I think you've covered the whole gamut of the range of questions there.
Well,
going back to your initial one is in terms of how companies view this or how companies might view this. I think we're maybe a stage or two away from companies making final decisions about Iraq. I mean, quite clearly, they regard the country as being a land of great opportunity. And, you know, they're aware of the reserves that are there. They're aware of the low cost of production there. And I think they believe that sort of access to Iraq really would be a first step in terms of some of the major oil-producing regions of the Middle East. But companies don't invest billions of dollars unless they have certain guarantees, and I think that's what companies are going to be waiting to see. They want to see what the contracts are going to look like, what terms are going to be offered, whether you get anything of the range of potential deals that have been discussed and hypothesized earlier in your show. They're going to want to know, I mean, first and foremost, probably what the constitutional situation is going to be. We've heard a lot of talk about reviewing the Iraqi constitution, coming up with a new constitution. Obviously, there are a whole host of political issues that need to be sorted out. And companies want to know that, you know, they're not investing billions of dollars and suddenly 3, 4, 5 years down the line, finding that the whole sector has been nationalized again or their terms have suddenly been changed. And that also goes to the issue of political stability. Well, they'll want to know that sort of these are fairly stable areas to produce in. These companies are risk takers, but they don't particularly want to see people shot up.
So a constitution is one thing, but it's just on paper. Dan Juergen.
Yeah, if I can add, when they sit down at the table, the Iraqis will say, gee, the geological risk is low, so we're going to have very tough terms. Mm-hmm. And the companies are going to say, well, the geological risk may be low, but believe me, the political risk is high. We don't know what's going to happen. As he just said, that they're not going to start spending billions of dollars until all of those things are clear. And I think it's right now it's not even clear what the nature of the new Iraqi government is going to be. So all of that's going to take time to sort out.
Morris Edelman, does that suggest that optimization of Iraq's oil resources will require U.S. involvement, U.N. involvement, pure Iraqi independence? What?
I don't know, but it's going to require time in which you learn what the limitations of the fields and the cost of getting the oil out. If it's going to take a lot of time, the sooner you get started, the better.
We've got a lot of callers who want to join this conversation. Let's turn to them. Jeff is calling from North Reading, Massachusetts. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks very much.
Sure.
Yeah, one of the things that I haven't heard a lot of talk about is the reparations aspect. Now, it was clearly, we don't want to create a situation like we did in post-World War I Germany where we crushed the country under the weight of the reparations and payments and so forth. But, you know, obviously the U.S. has racked up substantial debt in incurring this war. Iraq owed a lot of other countries a lot of money. And, of course, you've got the human rights lawsuits and so forth. Think of all the people who have perished in this who have claims against the government. And oil revenues are going to have to satisfy all those.
That's such a good question, because it isn't just Iraq has an enormous sort of list of things that it's going to need money for, beginning with reconstruction and all the things that you list, including the money, as you say, it owes for the Kuwait, for invading Kuwait.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to have a huge burden. And that's one reason it's going to want, I think, other people to make the investment to get it to gear up its oil industry rather than trying to eke it out itself.
But Daniel Yergin, there's something else in Jeff's question, this word reparations, and whether or not it's put about in the oil industry. You can well imagine it will be a political factor or in the U.S. debate of whether the U.S. expense on this war will, should, might ultimately come out of Iraq's oil fields. Can you imagine that happening, or is that totally out of bounds?
I can't imagine that happening, that we'd turn around and charge them for this.
If I could just add something in terms of that, which really follows on from a couple of things that Daniel Yergin was saying. There are a huge set of financial burdens that a new government in Iraq is going to face. Mm. I mean, just to put it into perspective, and to put it into perspective compared to the $100 billion that's been talked about in terms of selling rights, European estimates put reconstruction costs in Iraq over the next 10 years at something like $200 to $250 billion.
This is not just the industry, but the entire country.
That is the entire country. I think you mean, look, talking about the issue of reparations alone, I mean, you have somewhere in the region of about $187 billion plus a set of reparations potentially to the Iranians that have been hanging out there since 1991. Of $97 billion, and any sort of claims on top of that are sort of only going to add to that burden. Now, the one thing that I do think is interesting and perhaps sort of worth bringing into this conversation is a comment by Senator Grassley recently, who made the point that Iraq can pay for itself, can pay for the occupation, and can pay for its own reconstruction after a war. I don't see, in terms of the revenues that the Iraqis could get, whether they sold off their whole oil wealth right now, or in terms of the kind of revenues they would get from exporting oil, whether it be through tax and royalties or any other system, that they're going to be able to meet the cost of that reconstruction. And it's going to be tough to put the burden on a new Iraqi government.
We've heard this again and again, Daniel Yergin, the notion from U.S. officials that somehow post-war you've got a new U.S. or U.N. or Iraqi-led government that's got a better structure, and you just put the oil hose into it and everything goes swimmingly off into the future.
Well, as Rod said, the numbers just don't work. That, I mean, what Iraq has that Afghanistan didn't have is that it can really earn a significant living in the world economy. But it's much better to have $15 or $20 billion than not. But has so many different things it's going to need money for. Of course, Saddam Hussein has been siphoning off billions of dollars, including through illegally shipped oil, to continue to his arms enterprises. And the new government won't be doing that. But it's going to be whoever the new government is going to have a very big challenge ahead of it.
Well, I'm learning something right there. All that oil and still not enough to pay for reconstruction. We're talking tonight about the oil of Iraq and what happens with it post-Saddam. Should America post-war have any special claim on Iraqi oil? Can you see oil nurturing a rich, new, democratic Iraq? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the oil of Iraq and what happens with it post-Saddam. I'm learning tonight that Iraq won't be rich even with all that oil. It won't cover the costs of reconstruction. You can join the conversation as well. Should Washington bill Iraq's oil fields for the cost of this war? Or is that Washington's burden to bear? And what about those French and Russian oil deals? Should they go down the river with Saddam? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by quite a lineup. Morris Edelman, Professor Emeritus of Economics at MIT, author of The Genie Out of the Bottle, World Oil Since 1970. Pulitzer Prize winner Daniel Yergin, Chairman of Cambridge Energy Research Associates. And Rod Alkadiri, Director of PFC Energy, a Washington-based oil consultancy. You're welcome to join us as well. Matt's calling from Francistown, New Hampshire. Hi, Matt. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a comment. I don't think that it's right for us to go in there and basically take over the oil fields. For one, because of the political ramifications on an international level.
I guess nobody's suggesting that tonight. And yet we know that the kind of background of this administration. They've got a lot of oil field connections.
And that's my big concern is the energy sector relationships that they've built in with the meetings that Dick Cheney has had in the past. I'm just kind of concerned that there is a plan that we're not really being made aware of.
It's an interesting point to raise. Thanks for calling, Matt. Rod Al-Qadiri, how about it? You know better than we do, no doubt, how intimately connected this administration is to the oil business. Will we know if deals are being cut? Is it possible for the Bush administration to architect a post-war oil industry in such a way that it favors Americans without that being entirely clear to the whole world and everybody talking about it?
A lot has been said about this being a war for oil, and the administration's close links to the energy sector sort of really underline this. It's a claim that you hear a lot in Europe in particular and in the Middle East. I think that's a slight overstatement of the situation. In fact, a great overstatement of the situation.
And I really don't think it's what being asserted or asked about here, but rather something more specific. When the war comes to some kind of conclusion, do you imagine that the Bush administration can or would or could put its finger on the scales in terms of determining how contracts, how oil resources are distributed to companies, to American companies post-war?
Well, the issue here is, I think underlying the question is this an issue of a special relationship between the Bush administration and the energy sector? The Bush administration clearly has a number of people who have been involved in the energy sector in the past. But I think that the key to remember is, if you're pointing at some of the senior members, George Bush himself, Vice President Dick Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, et cetera. I think all of those were people who were in the industry, but were not of the industry, nor are they of the industry right now. I think they're politicians first and foremost. Will deals be made? I think that there is a situation right now, and you're beginning to see some of the beginnings of it, where with the U.S. taking the lead, and certainly if it continues to take the lead in the post-war reconstruction of Iraq and in the occupation, and certainly leading, ideas of leading a civil administration in Iraq and using organizations such as USAID, U.S. companies stand to gain an advantage. But I do think there is a broader political issue, and I think the administration's aware of that broader political issue. To go in and to give everything over to U.S. companies would not serve the purposes of this administration. It would tend to sort of belie the fact that this isn't a war about oil. And I think the administration is going to be aware that, and the Iraquis themselves who are going to be involved in this.
It would undermine the legitimacy of the new Iraqi government.
Daniel Yergin, we've got it. More settlement. Let me just put it to you. Do you know the industry well? Can you imagine a finger on the scales, deals being made, or is that just out of bounds somehow?
Well, you can prevent anybody putting his finger on the scale by having a system of open, competitive bids. It's been working that way for 50 years in the offshore United States. I see no reason why it can't work that way in post-war Iraq.
Can you imagine that the Bush administration might not want it to work that way if that obviated the possibility of an advantage?
I can't speak for the Bush administration. I don't know what they have in mind. The plan I propose, it keeps everybody's special influence away and makes it be determined by who is the lowest cost operator because he can afford to bid the most. Now, what use the Iraqi government makes of the money or what use they are forced to make of that money is something I don't know. But the more there is, the better off they are.
General Yergin, do you anticipate a transparent process here or something that's done under Iraqi covers or American covers or a combination?
I think based upon where we are now, I think it will be pretty transparent. I think never in the history of the world will the awarding of oil contracts be done under such a white heat of public attention. And I can just imagine if it isn't very transparent and open, the torrent of denunciations that you will hear. So I think a new Iraqi government will be thinking about its future, and I tend to think that the U.S. government is not, whether it's U.S. companies or not U.S. companies, I think actually what a U.S. government wants to see is the Iraqi oil industry restored as quickly as possible, producing as much oil as possible. I think that's the interest rather than whether this company or that company gets the contract, because the quicker that Iraq earns more money, the better the situation will be.
So the first Gulf War was paid for by others, and surely Washington's not looking forward to paying for this one. But you don't see any circumstance.
Bill here.
You don't see any way in which somehow a little hose gets put into the oil flow that somehow feeds back to Washington.
I haven't heard anybody proposing that. What I have heard is the sense that, well, it's going to cost $75 or $100 billion, but the explanation, the cost of not doing something would be much higher, but I haven't, and certainly we don't have the allies this time who are lining up to chip in.
And Rod al-Qadir, before we count the chickens before they're hatched here, the Kirkuk oil fields are still under Iraqi control, and overall, I don't know, some 1,500 wellheads in the country, many very high pressure, we read, that would burn with a lot more fire and smoke than those in Kuwait. Is it possible that before all this ends, we could still see a bunch of what's there in shambles?
I think it's possible, but I mean, I think, again, that needs to be put into perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot has been said and a lot has been written, and there's been a great deal of speculation about what was going to happen to the industry once the war started. And I think, you know, the evidence that you had in the south of the country was more than simply just very quick and very effective military operations. I think, you know, it's almost a contradiction to say on the one hand that the Iraqis sort of feel fairly nationalistic about their oil reserves, they will want to control them in the future, and they regard them as a national treasure, and then finding someone who's willing to blow them up. So
sure.
I think those are two separate things. But could it still happen? Possibly.
But I think it is one of the really sort of, in a sense, almost untold stories is how quickly those fields in the south were secured, because even a few days before that, mm-hmm. the expectation was that you were going to have a conflagration, an environmental disaster that would make Kuwait seem almost puny by comparison.
Didn't happen, but more oil fields to come in Kirkuk exactly. In the north. Our time is up, but I want to thank all of you for being with us tonight. Morris Edelman, Professor Emeritus of Economics at MIT, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
You're welcome.
And Rod al-Qadiri, joining us from Washington, director at PFC Energy, a Washington-based oil consultancy. Thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
And Daniel Yergin, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Prize, The Epic Quest for Oil, Money, and Power. The six-part TV series, Commanding Heights, The Battle for the World Economy, will air nationally, re-air, this May on PBS. He's chairman of Cambridge Energy Research Associates. Daniel Yergin, thank you for being with us tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Just click on forums. In a moment, a soldier's mother prepares for her son's deployment to the Middle East. This is On Point. Like many Americans, Sue Diaz has been watching television coverage of the war in Iraq with rapt attention. But the war could be hitting even closer to home for the San Diego writer in a matter of days or weeks. Diaz's 18-year-old son, Roman, is a member of the Army's 2nd Brigade, 1st Armored Division, which is scheduled to ship off to Kuwait any time now. In this radio diary, Sue Diaz struggles with the reality that could soon be her son she is seeing on TV, fighting in Iraq.
San Diego, the spring of 2000. Explosions reverberate, one, then another, followed by the rat-a-tat-tat of machine gun fire and shouts of men in camouflage uniforms. In the game on the computer screen in my son's bedroom, special forces are on the move, darting down the dark streets and alleyways of a simulated city. Like a lot of 16-year-olds in suburban America, my son loves his computer. I roll my eyes. "Mom, I'm just taking a break," my son says defensively. "This is a good game. See? My team's after the bad guys. And check this out. The graphics on this thing are incredible." I take a closer look. He's right. With a few well-timed clicks, realistic-looking men dash around corners, crouch behind walls, scan courtyards for suspicious movements, take aim, fire. In the distance, enemies fall. The men regroup and continue on. When they talk to each other, lips move, eyes blink. Amazing, huh? He says. Late March, 2003. I'm watching another amazing display of modern technology, the war in Iraq on American TV. And the boy who played at that computer now sleeps in an army barracks in Baumholder, Germany. He wakes each morning wondering if this is the day he and the rest of the 2nd Brigade, 1st Armored Division, pack their gear and guns and head for Kuwait. Those orders are already in place. Could be next week, could be next month, he said when he called home this past weekend. When he enlisted in the fall of last year, my son qualified for all 212 jobs the new Army offers. Unpredictable as ever, he chose the infantry. College can wait, and I don't want to sit behind a desk all day either. I like being outdoors. Hey, this will be an adventure, he said with the bravado guys his age own. His choice surprised everyone. Me, his dad and sister, the two Franciscan nuns who are his godparents, plus friends, teachers, neighbors, and relatives who still think of him as the kid who loves all creatures great, small, and scaly. These days in the forests of Germany, that same boy trains to do what soldiers have always done. And so, as Allied troops mass on the outskirts of Baghdad, I pick up the remote and click on the TV. In this war, through the miracle of video phones, I and the rest of the world ride along as our tanks roll across the Iraqi desert. We're right there with the soldiers at the front lines in real time, taking up our positions on family room sofas all across the country. We pass the potato chips and watch as real men in camouflage uniforms run and crouch behind berms of sand. Inside those tanks sit guys who'd no doubt give anything at this moment to be back at home, surfing the net, microwaving last night's pizza, programming their cell phones with girlfriends' phone numbers. Yet there they are, with so much of their lives still in front of them, on the road to Baghdad. It is not a Bob Hope movie, and it's certainly no game. And half a world away, we, the people who love them, watch, wait, and pray they'll come home safe and soon. For the most part, reporters and commentators do their best to treat this war sensitively, to put the whiz-bang conflict we're witnessing into its human context. Early on, Nancy Chamberlain, the mother of one of the first American soldiers killed in action, reminded the media of their responsibility to do exactly that. I truly admire what all the new technology can do, she said. But for the mothers and wives out there watching, it is murder. It is heartbreaking. We can't leave the television for a moment because we might see our sons or husbands. Now one of television's embedded reporters is talking via video phone about coalition losses. And as often the case with this new technology, there's a brief glitch in transmission. In the grainy picture, the TV journalist appears to move in fits and starts, freezes, then suddenly comes to life again. If only that fallen soldier, lying motionless on the top corner of the screen and shielded from full view by the backs of his comrades, could do the same. But this war is for real, and I may see my own son in it next week, maybe, or next month.
Sue Diaz is a writer living in San Diego, California. Her son Roman is a member of the Army's 2nd Brigade, 1st Armored Division. Listeners, as war rages in Iraq, we want to hear from you. How is the conflict affecting your life? What are you hearing from family and friends at home or overseas? If you have a story that would make a good radio diary, email us. The address is onpoint@wbur.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.